Good afternoon. So last time, we finished looking at our first case study of a very simple piece of self-replicating malware, the Vienna virus, well, one version of it, by looking in particular at how it would deal with adjusting its code and the code it inserted to jump to its code to deal with where exactly it would end up being in its new target executable. And we saw that it had this strategy of having this data address that it loaded into a register to locate things like, essentially, its equivalent of global variables, despite those locations being different in each executable and infected, and how it had to sort of produce a jump instruction at the beginning where, you know, where that jump instruction jump would change, it needed to compute that. And also how it needed to deal with, well, after it runs, it wanted to be stealthy, so it wanted to make sure the program it infected still did its normal thing, so it replaced that jump that it at the beginning with what was previously there and needed code to make that happen. And also a copy of what was previously there to make that possible. Then we looked into sort of real formats using the example of ELF, the format used on Linux, which just using because we have access to it and because it's typical of the design of other executable formats like PE on Windows or Mako on OS X. We saw that we had this header information that sort of divided up the executable into these pieces that were loaded, what ELF calls segments that were loaded. Which means that, you know, Vienna's old strategy doesn't quite work as is. Has to sort of take this different design into account. And then we started looking generally at sort of more generic virus code placement strategies. So we saw sort of the simplest ones, ones which were even sort of executable format neutral, where we just replace the executable and use some sort of temporary file or hidden file that we either like construct by copying it from the replaced executable to a temp location, executing that, or just having a hidden copy on the side. And we saw Vienna's strategy of appending. So questions on things we covered last time.
So quick question about the part of the quiz where it asks the size of the executable. It says, based on the program headers, how many bytes of possibly executable machine code? And so the answer was 0x225, but what the formula that I used to get the answer 0x3038 was to do the maximum offset and then add the file size, which is what we talked about in lecture. And I went back and rewatched.
So in lecture, we were answering the question of what's the size of the executable. And when I use executable as a noun, I mean the file. When I use executable as an adjective, I mean something you can't execute. So in this case, we're asking for machine code you can execute. So we look at our list of segments here, and we see that only one of them can have bytes we could execute, because all the others are loaded without this X flag. So that's where all the machine code has to be. And there's only 225 bytes of that, even though this executable file has a lot of other stuff that must be data. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so the executable file size I calculated correctly, but the actual number of bytes of executable machine code is a subset of that.
Yeah, because there's a lot of like constants and things like that in there.
Understood.
Could I ask a question about that same question?
About question two?
Yeah. The thing I was confused about was I was wondering, does the start address at all affect like what you are executing of the machine code? Because when I'd done like 0x225 and then I'd subtracted the start address because I just assumed you wouldn't execute what was before the start address in the machine code.
We could have jumps that go before the start address and probably, or calls, probably more likely calls. So I have a convenient example here. So in what is probably the same executable, so as a concrete example, where is that? Oh, I did put it in the right place. In this executable, the start address is here. Okay? But main is here. So the code which calls main is after main in the executable, and that's something which could happen. This is actually pretty common just because the linker and the compiler don't like really be careful about where they put main relative to other stuff.
Okay, so you can just jump back and forth. Like it's not, the start address isn't like a solid thing you have to abide by like when executing.
It's not the minimum address, it's just the first place that the OS will jump.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
So then we have other questions. So question 4 and 5. I added brief explanations here, so for the wrong ones, which I think is most people's confusions. So for A, in the original Vienna code, they need to do this sort of computation to compute the jump instruction depending on where it's appended. And being able to, replacing instructions that encode an address directly with one which code its relative doesn't help us there because that's already happened. The jump instruction that Vienna uses is already relative, and we still have the problem because the distance changes depending on what executable you're in. So that's why A wasn't correct. For C, we still are going to be replacing part of the executable to jump to Vienna. And if Vienna wants the normal executable to run normally, we still need to restore that. And, that's not made any harder or easier by this change. We can actually restore to an absolute address, and that's the most convenient way. And, using a relative address wouldn't make that easier. So as for question 5, the main point of confusion was this idea of splitting into sections. So my intent here, and I'll have to decide whether I want to like drop this option because I think people might have misinterpreted it, is that this is referring to the sections that identify what each part of the executable is for. And that part isn't important to Vienna because it doesn't care about abiding by that. Like, as long as it can add code that you can jump to, it doesn't matter if that's in a part of the executable that's not for meant to be for normal code, as long as it can be executed. So this is meant to be the general purpose, doesn't matter because Vienna doesn't need to abide by that, but it would matter if it was specifying rewriting execute. But in ELF, that's kind of separate from this purpose idea. In that this list of stuff in the program header is not the list of sections which tell you this is for text, this is for read-only data, and so on. This doesn't tell you why it's read-only, what it's for, why it's read-execute, what it's for. But I understand the confusion with that, and that probably makes it not a great question, so I'll consider whether I want to adjust the key on this. Make a decision after this. And there's a question what the correct answer for number 3 is. It was 400000, the address to which it's loaded, not the location in the file from which it's loaded.
A quick follow-up on the discussion around number 5. The reason why I answered the split into sections, and you were saying Vienna doesn't care if something's designated as read or write only, but does control flow does not actually stop something that is designated as read only?
I should phrase that differently. Vienna does care if it's specified as read only or not executable, but that's not this, what is the purpose of this part of the code or data information? It's a different piece of thing in the executable. So, this stuff here, this load doesn't tell you why what is this read-only section for? Is it global variable? Is it constants? Is it something else? You know, it doesn't tell you that purpose. But I understand that it's reasonable to think that that's maybe a bit ambiguous. So I'll think about rekeying that. And there's question number one. I'm not going to go through the details of getting this byte for time reasons, but if we look at the summary, the encoding we gave you uses this O1/R version, which is add RM to R, register or memory, sorry, add from into register or memory register. But you can also use this O3 version, which is the other way around, because these both support two register operands. So that's where the other encoding came from. Now, there might be other correct options. We'll check with grading. So like if you used a dummy prefix or something, we'll probably accept that, though that I don't think is the easiest way of answering the question and not what I expected. Okay. Back to here. So other things about other questions. Follow up comments. Okay, not seeing any, hopefully. So the question if why the second part of this was this was C1 instead of C8, that's because the two different versions place the register numbers in different places. So you can see that the O3 is this RM version, which uses reg then RM for the register numbers, and O1 is this MR version, which is the other way around. And this is the Intel's manual, so this is all these listings here are in Intel syntax. Anything else? Okay. So, a scheduling note. Wednesday is a break day, so there's no lecture. The quiz for this week will be released by tomorrow morning. There's still an RE assignment, reverse engineering assignment, due Friday. Okay. So we were looking at places to put code if you're some sort of self-replicating malware like a virus. But mentioned this idea of replacing executables. We saw Vienna did this after executable code. We're going to look at that again with our new knowledge of real executable formats in mind. So we want to do this, but we can't actually just do insert our jump and append the virus code and have it work in a normal executable. So what can we do? Let's look at ELF. And I mentioned in ELF, the part which matters are these program headers. This is what we want to change. So a way we could do this is, I meant to have an 8 here. You'll see why. So here I have a normal ELF executable that we're going to start out with. And our goal is going to be to figure out what will we have to do what Vienna does and make it work to append something here with these load instructions. So what we'll do is I'm going to show first a strategy where I'm going to just modify this last load here to add some data to it. So to make that work, first I'm going to extend it to include the trailing zeros, because when we started out here, we have this difference between the file size and mem size, which means there's added zeros in memory. So to make that work, I'm just going to append the virus code to there. So I'm going to extend the file size to add those zeros explicitly, just so I don't have to do, extra work to make those zeros be there. And then I'm going to add on the virus code at the end of it and increase the sizes, and also flip the flags to make it executable. So that would be sort of, one way that we could do this on an ELF file. Another simpler way is we could just add a new load statement, assuming we can find room in the header, which usually would be the case, but maybe this would sometimes be tricky because, where is there going to be space for this? Questions about this? And I guess I should mention, I may be oversimplifying what's needed to make this really work, because there might be some other things that we need to fix up. This would be our basic idea, that the virus is going to need to do some extra work to edit this what to load information to append itself. But that's not actually that difficult. And something that, at least on like the equivalent of Windows for this, real viruses have done. Now, something you might say about appending is, though, gosh, if we look at these strategies, this replacing is really obvious. This appending makes our executables bigger. That might be something the user would notice. They might run out of disk space. So there's sort of a variant, which has historically been common, of things that keep the executable size the same. And a simple way of doing that is to do the sort of replacing executable strategy, but use compression. And just uncompress, just runs a little slower, and you can make the size exactly the same and sort of avoid that cheap technique where someone might accidentally realize what's happening. Now, another way of achieving the same goal of having the executable the same size, and perhaps making it so we don't have to worry so much about fiddling around with these program headers or doing the work of making a temporary executable and running it, is that we could insert sort of malware or stuff to call malware in unused executable code or space. And you might say, wait a moment, there's unused space? Well, Yes, there is. One thing we've kind of seen is when we've looked at sort of the ELF format, we saw that when I showed you these typical examples, we're often loading these non-contiguous segments. So, here's an example that you might see in a real Linux executable. We load this amount of bytes. So, if we look at sort of our executable, we're going, where this is higher addresses, 0. So this stuff is loaded. And then we start with at 400 and go to, and this stuff is loaded. And that means that there's this gap, which we aren't using. And the reason for this, we mentioned before, is that the OS wants to do things that are page aligned. That's the unit in which it allocates memory that happens to be this OX1000. And so the executable is laid out with that in mind. And when doing this, some leftover space is there. This can be pretty substantial. And a strategy someone might use, if you want to insert code here, is that you just put your malicious code in this gap. And often it's the case that even though we're saying to only load this stuff, because the OS works in pages, it will often load the remainder of the stuff, even if you don't edit this to a bigger number. But if you needed to, you could.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
Just with like that space before that fort, like, because I remember from last time, right, we kind of discussed the executable couldn't be low, like nothing could be touched below the 4,000 value or whatnot. Is this, are you talking about that area right now? Since that's the space that we could.
So this is the file on disk. And I haven't shown you where this is being loaded, but most likely it's not being loaded to address zero. And so, like, this might be loaded to, say, this address, in which case, you know, this will end up at a higher place in memory. I actually have a prepared slide for this. So if we have a load like this, this says to get from this far into the program on disk, this much, and load it to this address. And generally when this is done, there won't be anything loaded at the lower addresses, just so null pointers, you know, don't do anything bad. Or rather, you know, actually crash. So nothing's loaded around where null pointers would be. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
So another question is, what if two programs use the same virtual address, have the same address to load to? Each program gets the illusion of its own memory. If you want to find out how that works, take a class where you learn about virtual memory, like 3030 or 4414 or the CPE architecture class. But the OS can give each program its own memory layout, which is going to be very important later in the semester when we talk about ways of mitigating things like buffer overflows. Does that answer that question or other questions? And then there's a question about, so what about p-adder? For our purposes, we're mostly going to ignore p-adder. The reason there's two separate fields are for cases where the address to which you load is different than the address which is going to be used at runtime. But this is not something that comes up on a typical OS. Okay, so this is one form of extra space. This is this gap between these different segments of a program, typically because we have to align things. There's another thing you'll see when you're looking at executables, you often find that they're nops. And more than just nops, you know, for Linux executables, you'll see these nops, and you may notice that, wait a moment, now there's a jump here that doesn't jump to here, so this is actually unreachable. And the same is true here. There's a return that's not going to return to here because it was called from somewhere else. There's not a call above here. So this is unreachable. So there are these unreachable, on Linux, typically nops. And you might say, well, why are they there? Like, what was the compiler and linker thinking by putting these sort of just wasted instructions? You know, why didn't it start this move earlier? Or this move earlier? Why did it waste this extra space? And there's a reason for it, which is related to, you know, how the hardware works. So if you look up Intel's manuals for how do you make code fast on Intel processors, they will tell you all branch targets, and branch targets means anything you jump to or call, should be 16 byte aligned, meaning they should start at an address which is a multiple of 16. And there's reasons in the hardware why this is better. This works better with the caches in the hardware, works better with Intel's design for the logic that handles decoding the machine code, which, as we've learned, is probably quite complicated in the hardware. So since this is faster, our compiler and linker has figured out how to do it. So it said, well, the place where I want to put a function that's going to be called is here, or something that's going to be jumped to is here, and there's a return just before, well, I need to fill in this empty space, and they decide to fill it in with nops. Now, you might say, well, if this is unreachable, why is this filled in with nops and not like a bunch of zeros? And there's also a reason for that. The Intel manuals also say, placing data immediately following an indirect branch can cause performance problems. If the data consists of all zeros, it looks like a stream of adds to memory destinations, and this causes can cause resource conflicts. So Intel tells you that their CPUs are silly, and when you have, a branch before it, they might continue decoding instructions and get confused. If those instructions look like they might do something, that might cause the program processor to run slow. So to avoid that, the linker and assembler inserts nums. Also has some other advantages that it's like better for disassembling and debugging, and you have to put something there anyway, so it's kind of free. But there are some other platforms where they might put different instructions. So, for example, Sourcebook says, at least on old Windows, you used to see them put like an instruction that just always crashes. But this is a form of unused space. And hypothetically, you could use this for malicious code. You could just find these. Good question is how, and insert your code in. Another example of unused space is in the executable metadata. So we saw that we had this like list of program headers and so on, and often a bunch of space will be allocated for the program headers, but not all of it will actually be useful. For example, the linker might say, okay, I'm going to allocate space for N fields, maybe N is like 64, and maybe I won't use all of them. And given that you have to align the code to a page, that might be very harmless. And an example of how this happens on Linux is with information for dynamic linking, which we probably will talk about briefly later today. So in dynamically linked executables, there's a section in the header that just tells the dynamic linker about things to do in this .dynamic section. And it's basically an array of structs with a long type, long value. And if you look at it in a typical executable, you'll see, okay, type value 0, type value 0, type value, type value. And then you see a whole bunch of zeros. And if you look up what that means, this is just filler space. That they had space for more information to help the dynamic linker, and they didn't need all of it. And since the dynamic linker isn't using this, well, you could put something else here. And this might be a place where malware could insert itself without making the executable any bigger. And as a bonus, like this is already loaded into memory, so the dynamic linker can use it, so you don't need to change that. So there's a question is, aren't the sections never run just used for linker? So I think you're asking, like, isn't this not executable? Yeah, it's not executable. So there's a question of whether it's loaded in a way which you can execute. And if it's not, you could just do the trick of flipping this bit to executable if it's not already listed as executable. Or you could use the space to store non-executable data that your malicious code uses. Okay. So we have a whole bunch of these different types of sort of empty space and executable that potentially seems like a space that malicious code could use. And let's think about the way something like a virus like Vienna works. So Vienna had this nice property that it just, you ran it, it could infect any executable. So it was, that's why it was one reason successful, even though it was pretty simple, You know, it could just infect any executable. But let's think about, well, if we want to be stealthy like this and just use unused space in executable, what is, you know, how could we, let's think about how could we find these examples of unused space, you know, automatically. So which seems hardest, which seems easiest? This is subjective. There's not like a single right answer. So, for least difficult, people say generally A or C. This matches my intuition. And most people think B is most difficult. And I would agree. I think B is most difficult. Now, the case for B not being difficult is, well, you're looking for nops. Nops have a particular byte sequence. You just scan the executable for that byte sequence. You don't need to bother with figuring out how ELF works. So that's sort of the case for why it might be actually simple to find that extra space. Because why would there be other big nops in the, like big runs of nops in the executable? The case against it is what? How are you going to mess up? So let's look at this. So let's say we just scan for this pattern of two nops in a row. What are cases where, you know, we might mess up, where this might not actually be that unused space? Or yeah, we look for this pattern, even like a return followed by some numbers. Another 15 seconds. Okay, so we have a bunch of cases. So I'll show you which ones I think are a concern. So I think A is a concern. Now it's not obvious why. Why would this be part of another instruction? But it's pretty easy to construct an instruction that would contain C3, the opcode for return, not there. And this would be something like move C3 into AX. This is an example of an instruction which, when encoded, is going to contain C3 in it near the end. And this could cause some confusion. And we could even, you know, have it contain something that's even more likely to look like this, like, you know, 0FC3. So we get, like, both of these bytes could be, like, part of the constant for a move or something like that. So that's a concern, you know, that because we can have constants in machine code, any byte in x86 machine code could be, you know, not an opcode, even if it looks like it's usually an opcode. And when we're looking at this assembly, well, our disassembler like looked at all the previous instructions, but if we're just writing something to scan for these bytes, we're probably not going to have a full disassembler because that sounds really complicated. So B, I don't think is a concern, because to make this likely, we would need to like have a call here, but there's not a call. So I don't think this is likely. Like, hypothetically, we could have done something like to jump function instead of a call, and then it would return there, but that doesn't seem very likely, just because there's no call before this. For C, some instruction might jump to one of the bytes after, so this is hypothetically possible. Now, it doesn't seem likely if it's jumping to where one of the knobs start, but if we have this confusion about whether, you know, maybe this is an instruction or something, then that might be a concern, right? That maybe there's really a jump that points to here, that would might make sense, and would be a problem. Like, if there's something in the middle here that's a real instruction. And D is also possible, that this could be in the program's data, in which case the program's looking for C3 as like part of an image or something, and if we change this, it will cause some problems. So questions about sort of my analysis of this? These sort of possibilities? So can I go over why I don't think B is likely?
Yes, please.
So the byte immediately after is a knob. So it seems unlikely the compiler would deliberately return to this knob in general, right? Because usually we're not going to have knobs that our compiler actually wants to run, right? Otherwise, we just put the code that we don't want to run knobs that slow. So that's one reason why I don't think it's likely the compiler would have code that tries to return to here. Another reason why is that usually if we return to somewhere, we expect it to be after a call, right? And we don't see a call about this. Is that those two explanations sort of make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
But there are a bunch of things to be concerned about if we do this sort of just look for these bytes, hope we find, you know, this machine code that meets this. Another thing we might note is that a lot of these cavities, especially these sorts of things, look a little small. And, you know, they seem limiting for malware, which might have ambitious goals for things it wants to do. But there's a solution to this, which is that you can, like, chain these together. And there's been some real malware. The CIH is an example in Shore's book that was for Windows that basically looked for these empty spaces. And what it would do, it would have, in the program header, it would find some space for, you know, the virus startup code and just a list of locations, and it would put the actual code scattered throughout the program. And when the virus ran, it would just allocate some memory, copy all these pieces together, and run them. So we didn't even have to worry about, like, setting up jumps between the parts because it just copied it into a new location. Also didn't need to worry about whether the parts were executable or not. Just had to make this code up here executable. And this has the added advantage, as we'll talk about later, that it make it harder to, you know, search for something in this executable and know it's infected with the virus. Because if we look for part of the virus code, well, if what we're looking for is here and here, we won't find it. Unless we realize that there's going to be a gap with a bunch of stuff, and that seems to let us have a bunch of false positives if we aren't careful. So questions about this it's like it's an unpacking the virus out of the code. So the question is, did it add new load instructions to chain the code together? So not in the sense of changing the program headers to load each of these pieces. Instead, this startup code here manually copies from the executable. to Malak new memory, newly allocated memory. So the virus author wrote their own code that just allocates some memory and copies these little sections into it, then jumps there. The question was, does it create a new process? No, this would run as part of the infected program. Similar to how Vienna worked. It would probably run before the infected program, then run the infected program as usual. Other questions? Follow up? So the question is, does inserting the virus code into these spaces slow down the CPU? So if you're inserting stuff that does something, Intel suggests it might slow down the CPU. Probably it's not significant in most cases. And certainly it will still work. And I guess I should mention that the slowdown here, we're talking about resource conflicts. So my impression is that this is saying things like you might have a few extra cache misses or something like that, which is not going to be very noticeable if you aren't looking for it, would be my guess. I'm not sure if that would always be the case, but my guess would be that it would be rarely noticeable. Okay. So another sort of place that sort of malware wants to place itself is inside operating system code. And sort of there's three different targets we might think about. And to think about this, I'm going to look at the boot process. So we start our machine, reset the processor, and first some startup code runs that is part of what we call the BIOS, the basic input-output operating system, or EFI on modern computers, which is generally sort of in a chip on the motherboard. So this is the code which knows how to do things like start the disk, or SSD. And this is very CPU and motherboard specific. This is not generic code. And this actually starts loading the OS, but typically this code does not actually know how to load the OS. Instead, it loads what's known as a bootloader, which is a component of the OS that handles the rest of loading the OS. And most notably, the bootloader usually understands where files are, and the BIOS or EFI usually doesn't, or doesn't enough to actually load the OS into memory. So the bootloader will understand this, read the files, and actually start the OS. And historically, a huge concern for viruses has been bootloader viruses. Viruses that infect this bootloader. And particularly in the DOS era, this was a big problem. Because in the DOS era, when you use machines, you often would boot from floppies. Software you would get would sometimes be distributed as a bootable floppy. You might not have a hard drive because they're expensive. And bootloaders were, something you could install in any floppy. So there was code that targeted it. If you inserted a floppy to save something, why not add a bootloader to that? And historically, on these old DOS systems, and also for surprisingly long afterwards, basically into everything that calls the boot process a BIOS, the bootloader would be on the first sector of the device, meaning the floppy, hard drive, SSD, etc. So that's 512 bytes. Yes, it means it has to be pretty small. And there would be code in the BIOS that would copy that into RAM, jump to it, and start running it. And So there were viruses which targeted it. So one example is Stoned was a name of a virus that existed on DOS systems, and what it would do is you'd have your floppy with a bootloader and information about how the file system works, so what files there were here, and Stone would just copy it to some random location on the disk and insert its own bootloader that was a virus and would infect other systems and then go and, similar to what we saw with Fianna, jump to the normal bootloader so everything looked normal. And you might notice a difficulty here is, wait a moment, how did we find this space? And apparently Stone's strategy was just choose a location that probably doesn't have files, and if it does, oops. Which, as you can imagine, can cause some problems when that assumption doesn't actually work out. So, modern bootloaders don't work quite so simply. So the sort of new thing is this UEFI, sort of the dominant version of the software that loads the bootloader to load the OS, and loads the OS. And it isn't quite so simple to add something to the boot entry. But the same sort of principles apply. Now, talk about sort of this process. Another possible target for malware is earlier in this process, that rather than targeting the code that the OS uses to load itself, let's target the code that the CPU or motherboard manufacturer provided to load that code that the OS uses to load itself. You know, that would be in a chip on our motherboard. And typically this is changeable because we sometimes have bugs in this code and need to fix them. And there's often been a lot of concern about the rare instances of malware that tries to replace this code with a malicious version. So it's infrequent because that code is really non-portable. And updating it often requires physical access. Sometimes you need to have something cryptographically signed, or need to figure out a way the cryptographic signature checking is broken. But the reason why this has been a major concern is that it's extremely hard to remove, because you have to replace this component, which is not what you think about. Like, it's in a chip on the motherboard. Like, you can change the disk and it's still there. And there have been reports of, you know, what is often called implants that use this to try to persist other malware, where basically there will be some code that tries to reinstall some piece of malicious software if it's not present on the OS and then boot the OS. And this is, you know, kind of concerning because this is, you know, hard to remove and also kind of hard to detect. There's a question, are UEFI and BIOS necessarily separate? So generally, well, not generally, but often UEFI systems support running things like a BIOS because they have to support OSs that are used to the older system for booting. So you might see systems which support both kind of interfaces, both the UEFI design for how the OS should expect to be booted and the BIOS design for how OS should expect to be booted. Not systems, but yeah, hardware that supports that. So the other sort of major concern here is that we could have files in our file system be infected. So a simple strategy, you know, is that we can add some new startup program, some program that just runs automatically, you know, and runs in the background. And there's a lot of legitimate ones of these. So it's kind of easy to blend in, and alternately, you could infect a system program that happens to be running all the time. And this is sort of a common concern with malware, is that, you know, this is one thing it will spread to. And another option for infection that's related to this inside OS code is you might put code in memory. You might say, wait a moment, that doesn't let the code stay around, but this is sort of a... So sort of something you might, malware often will do in addition to infecting executables is that it will keep itself in memory so it can infect more stuff. Like it will insert itself into OS code in memory, but not on disk, so it can keep running even after the executable that, you know, it was infected into has stopped running. Okay. And so later on, we're going to need to think about detecting these. And one thing you might think about is, well, we have these different ways that malware might compromise an existing system or executable, which would be easiest to detect sort of in general or hardest. If we're just looking at, is there something fishy about this program or whatever? And there's a question here, so I'm asking about bootloader. Bootloader, this is the OS code to load the OS that is run by the motherboard code, by the processor provided stuff code. Boot code. And the question is, what I mean by replace executable? This is the strategy where we do something like make it be virus original executable, where we do that transformation. So we have the original executable, we just put the virus, then the original executable afterwards, and the virus like extracts the original executable to a file and runs it, rather than like trying to modify the executable and have it mostly work as is. Or where alternately we do the strategy of just replacing it with a virus, not having the original executable work. Give another 5-10 seconds or so. Okay, so we have some intuition that people think A, B, and E are easiest, and think C and D are hardest. I guess there's a question of identify for who. So I when I wrote this question, I was thinking of if I'm writing anti-malware software, what is the easiest for me to detect in that anti-malware software? And one way I might think about this is, well, for this, for A and B, we have a sudden change in file size that maybe is something that's suspicious. We also have, you know, possible weirdly for A, like we have executables being written, executables and temp files, or it doesn't work the same. Same. So both of the, so A seems easiest to me, B has this change in size, and also possibly executable data at the end of exec that's unusual. So that seems like a big sign, but I'd worry that A and B are, like, susceptible to false positives because, well, if an executable changes in size a bunch, maybe it's just a software update. And if there's executable stuff at the end of an executable, maybe that's just a different compiler works that way. So it's, like, these don't seem certain, but it seems relatively easy. Replace cavities seems a little trickier to search for. And also, notably, like, seems like we have to, like, look carefully, but... And I also worry, what if the compiler's doing something weird? So, a newly started system program, so... One idea for why this would be easy is that this is a separate program, and someone's mentioning just have a list of common program hashes. So you just have that's a strategy that is very easy for E, right? That if the hash of the program is always the same, you just look for this program when I run. You know, SHA-SUM over it, I get this value, that program's malicious, this seems easiest to find for if that's the case. And it doesn't have the issues that we have with B, that it's going to be unique for every infected executable. So that seems simpler. And so someone's saying, wait, shouldn't checking the checksum, like I suggest for E, work for C? So the issue with C is that, well, we would need to know what the checksum for the legitimate executable is. So one idea that you have here is that you say, well, if we know what the executable is supposed to be, like what the version of like chrome.exe is, we could just say, okay, chrome.exe has this hash. If it doesn't match, that detects B, C, and so on. The problem with that is that we need to keep that checksum up to date, and we need to not have problems if it disagrees. So I agree that that's a valid strategy, but the issue is that, you know, it works less good when programs are being legitimately updated. Whereas if we're doing checksums to look for something that we know is malicious, you know, that's probably going to be more reliable as far as false positives go. We aren't going to tell people this might be malware just because Chrome got updated. We're going to tell them this might be malware because I've seen this program before and it was malware that time. Okay. Now, a lot of you said that D would be most difficult. So I think D is probably easier because if you read the bootloader, generally, this is part of the OS, you know, this generally doesn't change much. So, and this is, remember, in our diagram, the bootloader is here. It's not the processor-specific stuff. It's, you know, common to the OS. So I wouldn't be worried about it changing much, so probably I can just say, if it changed, that's very suspicious. And it doesn't change much because, you know, you write this code once and the stuff it loads is what changes, not the bootloader, most of the time. So questions about sort of my assessments of these? I have a pro con that I need to extend to multiple slides. For review later. But questions, comments? So a question with E, isn't there a problem with keeping the list of checksums up to date? Absolutely. Also, particularly if the process deliberately changes itself, 100%, and that is a topic we will get to in a lot of detail. So there's a topic we're gonna go over to of polymorphic or metamorphic malware, where malware deliberately changes itself because people are doing things like having a hash of malicious programs. So we'll talk about how that works in a lot of detail later in the semester. Okay. some thinking. Now, we talked about where we can put code, and we incidentally talked about a way we could execute code that was malicious, and one place is putting it in the bootloader. But another thing we want to do is we want to actually run the virus code. And with Vienna, the strategy was we inserted the jump at the start location. And we can use the same strategy in some more sophisticated format like ELF, and it's actually easier because ELF and other modern executable formats have a start address, which could be anywhere in the loaded stuff. So you can just change it. You don't need to do that funny work of adding a jump and then moving and then replacing the jump. You know, you can just move it. Now, there's some other strategies besides just changing the start given start location that maybe are a little more subtle. Because the problem with this strategy is that, you know, it's going to be maybe easier to detect because, this will probably end up being changed to a location a compiler would be very unlikely to generate. You could maybe look for that particularly changing. So more stealthy strategies might include editing other parts of the program. So one option is that there's code that's going to be run anyways. And Vienna kind of did this by modifying the code at the beginning, which it knew would be executed. But we have other options. And this is another case where that observation of cavities comes in really handy. So for example, one thing we could do, and we're actually going to have you do this for an upcoming assignment, tricky as an option, is that if we see like a return, we could replace it with a jump. And since there's often this padding for alignment, we might even have space to do that without needing to worry about what about the existing instructions there. Let's just we don't need to worry about it. We just jump to some code that ends in a return and we're done. And there's other patterns like this you could look for. You could look for like a call that goes somewhere and make it go to your inserted virus code. So there's a whole lot of options, and these are a lot trickier to look for because you can't just look at the start location for the virus. It could be embedded somewhere in the middle of the program. Now, a challenge with a virus trying to do this strategy is that you need to find this, this code, this case where you want to insert it, and we have all the issues about false positives I mentioned earlier. So when we were thinking about how could this pattern of bytes not actually be a return in some empty space, well, now we're going to be concerned about that because if we misidentify it, we might be breaking the program. But maybe, looking for this is going to be good enough. And there's been real malware which does this kind of strategy, maybe not looking for this pattern, but looking for things that are typical of function beginnings and ends and replacing them with malware code. And you can do this more generally. You can just look for any particular instruction that you know about, replace it with a jump, and find it. And all you need to be concerned about is you want to mostly avoid replacing the middle of an instruction. And hopefully, if you look for a particular pattern, that's probably good enough. If you really care, maybe you could do better. So another example is you can look for function calls. So you can say, function calls start with an E8 and a 32-byte value. This is call foo. This is the machine code for it. You could look for E8, but you'd have lots of false positives. So you're going to say, this seems like not a very practical strategy. If it has lots of false positives, there's lots of random value instances of this byte. But there's some malware which just said, we can limit the false positives by just looking at what this address is and figuring out if it looks like a function, because most of the time, it won't. And the strategy that some 32-bit malware used is it said, most of the functions generated by compilers these days on 32-bit at the time had started with this push and move sequence of instructions. So they just looked for a call that pointed to a push followed by a move, replaced one of them with a call to the virus code, and then that's how they inserted their equivalent of Vienna's jump. And this kind of strategy where we're looking for, you know, a particular call and verifying that it looks like it starts a function, it's very likely that we're going to avoid those false positives. And it's not actually that hard to write your virus code because you're just scanning for particular bytes. You're scanning for E8, then you're like doing a bit of math and looking for this 55890C. And as long as the files you're infecting look like what you expect, it'll work in, you know, almost always find a function call and make it a little hard to look at the executable you infected and quickly figure out whether it's infected because, well, it could have infected any of the call instructions. You have to, like, scan all the machine code to figure it out. So we saw this strategy of sort of replacing an existing call, so on. You might say, well, what do we do if we do this to make it so we don't disrupt the normal program? And probably what you do in this case is that, you know, we had a call foo, and we're going to, the virus is going to replace it with a call virus, and it's going to write its virus code. And the simple solution is it can end its virus code with a call foo. Or rather, not a call foo, a jump foo. So that's, you know, how this can still be stealthy. And the tricky code is just it needs to figure out, it needs to find the call foo to replace and also, you know, take its template for its code and make sure it inserts the address of the original foo it found that it replaced later. So another strategy is that you could just replace any old instruction and then just have a backup copy of the original code and replace it afterwards. And you might have looked at our loads earlier on and say, wait a moment. You showed me earlier on that when we loaded stuff that was executable, it wasn't writable. You know, there's no write here. But that's not really an obstacle if you actually know you're replacing code, because you can just ask the OS to make it writable again. So, for example, on Linux, you just call the library call mprotect. It makes it writable. No problem. Not actually, you know, it's not a security limitation, it's just a preventing mistakes limitation. So, you know, the system is not going to stop you from deliberately overwriting machine code. Okay. So, that was going over sort of this idea that, well, we can look for patterns in machine code and edit them so we can, like, look for calls, look for returns, and something that real viruses do is they try to replace those rather than something so obvious as changing the starting location of an executable. And related to this, there's a whole category of stuff related to dynamic linking, which is another strategy for inserting calls to sort of our malicious code. But to talk about that, we're going to need to understand how dynamic linking works. And sort of the hint given here is that there's lots of going to be function pointers, pointers to functions involved in dynamic linking that are going to be options to replace. But before I move on to that, questions about sort of my idea about sort of like replacing calls and returns and so on. Okay, so let's do a brief 5-minute beginning introduction into dynamic linking, which we'll obviously finish up next week. So Linking is the process of, like, taking, like, our call printf and turning it into, like, an actual address. A call with some particular address. And static linking is the name we give to linking to create an executable. So linking where we do that replacement as part of creating executable. Whereas if we do that replacement of names with addresses when the executable is run, we call this dynamic linking. And conceptually, these seem the same. We're just replacing the names at different points. But the mechanisms are actually very different in practice. When we're doing dynamic linking, there's going to be extra indirection. And the goal of this is to avoid modifying code at runtime. And this is just basically for performance reasons, and that operating systems and linkers want to avoid this, so they don't want to have to, like, change every single call. So instead, what they do is when you have a call printf that's dynamically linked, it gets converted into a call lookup table something. You know, and the dynamic linker fills in this dynamic linker fills in the lookup table. Table instead of the most obvious thing of changing the call instruction. So they could change the call instruction itself, but they just decided not to do that. They decided they'll have this lookup table, so there's less stuff to change when loading a program, and the idea is that's faster. So there's a question, does this happen at compilation time or runtime? This happens at the time the executable file is produced, that this replacement happens, and the lookup table gets populated at runtime. We'll look at some more details of that. But first, an interlude into some other quirks of dynamic linking with a tool called strace. So strace is a system call tracer. It traces system calls, that's program requests for operating system services. So I have a hello world program. I run it to produce an executable. And here are the system calls I see. I have a bunch of standard library startup stuff. Even though they're spread in all the world, you know, allocating memory and the what puts does. Okay. So, and then an exit. So there's nothing here that's unexpected. For researching, like, how the standard library works. This is all standard library stuff, followed by, allocating memory, followed by running the code I wrote, which calls a library function that uses these services. So in particular, all this stuff, you know, I can find the code that does this, does each of these in the executable. Now, if I look at a dynamically linked version of the same program, I find out that there's some extra stuff going on. So one thing is that my call to puts, to print out a string, is something that's going to use the standard library, and that is in fact opened by the program that's produced. So somehow this executable that I produced, this hello.exe, has code that opens libc.so.6, which contains the C standard library code for puts. And I can look through object dump, look at the disassembly, and nowhere in there am I going to find the code that makes this open call. You might say, wait a moment, how does that work? Well, on Linux, the way dynamic linking works is a little strange. That executables can have what's known as an interpreter. So there's actually a different program. On Linux, it's typically this program, sometimes might have different names, I'm not sure this is the current name, but have an interpreter like, you know, something like this. So there's a program that's for loading programs, and this actually gets run instead of hello.exe to load hello.exe. And this is mentioned in the program header as this interp instruction. So this interp instruction says, hey, the way we're actually running this program is by running this other thing called, and which is at this file name. And this process is, so Linux, I think, has a particularly quirky way of doing it. I think Windows is, you know, doesn't do this type of strategy, but we still have this general pattern that when dynamic linking's in use, there's going to be code that actually handles doing the dynamic linking stuff, which is not really part of the executable. That's going to be reloading files, opening them, and so on, sort of to load the executable. That's a whole bunch of code that gets to run. Now you might say, how does this know what to load? This is not the standard library. Well, another thing that's in my executable in that program header, in addition to that interp instruction, is this dynamic instruction, which links to this dynamic section, which has information including, hey, this program needs this library to run. It says, okay, you need to load this library to run. It also has things like, oh, this is where the constructors are. And in addition to this sort of list of what library we need to run, there's going to be information about like what functions are needed, what's in the lookup table, and so on. And we'll talk about that next time. And in particular, something that's going to be interesting when thinking about malicious code is that, well, if we have this lookup table that points to a function, well, if we wanted to infect an executable, we could make it point to a different function. Or we could change this call that will turn out is going to be at a well-known location, which we're going to be told because the linker needs to know where it is, for example. So this would be sort of another vector that malicious software will use to figure out where can I get my code called, because the dynamic linking infrastructure that like loads the standard library knows where the standard library is called, you know, sets up calls to the standard library. You can change it to like set up calls to your virus. So that's where we'll pick up next time. As I said, there's no lecture Wednesday. The RE assignment's due Friday. You should know enough to do the following tricky assignment, which will be posted by Friday. That's where I'll leave off today. I'll take questions before I sign off.
Could you point to an entirely different interpreter? Would that be...
That is valid and should work. I don't know that it's tested, so... But yes, you could point to a different interpreter that should work. Yeah, I just... It's not something that's commonly done, so I wouldn't be surprised if it breaks in weird ways, just because it's not, like, a used part of the OS code.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions?